session number 24694, reel 2.
Mr. Gabbett, reel 2. We were talking about the developing process. Did they teach you about the different sorts of photographic paper and the chemicals you had to use? Can you tell us a bit about that?
Well, the basic process was for developer, rinse it, hypo to fix it, wash it, and dry it. And the same thing happened with the printing as well. Also, we were trained in contact prints, enlargements, how to use the enlarger. And I was saying we had a week on the mobile darkroom, a big six-wheeled Austin lorry with a small darkroom on the back.
Were there things to learn about the chemicals? Because, I mean, not all the chemicals are entirely safe, are they? I mean, you have to be careful with handling, or was this something just taken as...
No, we knew that tin was developer, and that was it. I mean, what made up the developer? No, we didn't go...
So you didn't go too far into the process?
No. I mean, what chemicals were in the developer? No.
You were more just carrying out a procedure?
Yes.
The fact you had a couple of wrinkles to sort of get by some of it.
Yeah.
And what about them? Can you tell us a bit more about the mobile dark room? Because I've not heard of them.
Well, the idea was that this was the dark room that went to a forward area. Admittedly, the one that we trained on was a bit obsolete and a bit out of date. But it literally was a dark room on the back of a lorry with connections to connect up water and electricity either to the mains if it was available or a portable generator. And that was all it was. It was a dark room with enlargers and contact printers and developing tanks and so forth, but inside on the back of a lorry.
And anything else you were learning as a photographer? Did they still have the fixed cameras at the bottom of the machines?
Yeah, but we didn't really touch on that on the course.
So it was really more the handheld, the F24.
The basic. See, when I joined the RAF...
Was it a big camera, the F24?
No, but so big. And the magazine about that square and about that deep.
So about more than a foot square, the whole thing?
Yeah.
So not something you'd want to carry too much?
No, I mean, later on when I was on the Photographic Reconnaissance Squadron, then we did have a big one. I mean, the F-52 stands about that high and weighs 100 weight.
Were the cameras the same kind of basic principle as a normal camera?
They all the one, apart from the Cinegun camera, all the ordinary cameras, used a focal plane shutter. A blind, in effect, with a slot in it. And when it made the exposure, the blind whipped across the register. See, the camera had a square glass register plate, and the film went across that, and the magazine was clamped on top of it. So when it took the exposure, the shutter went and then rewound. And all the aircraft cameras were like that. They didn't use the diaphragm shutter.
And you wouldn't be learning how to repair other than simple repairs?
No. Major repairs would either be done by instrument repairers... would do that, but in fact our cameras were relatively simple and there wasn't much to go wrong with them. They were extremely good, very reliable, very robust.
Good quality lenses?
Yes, extremely good quality. Williamson's was the firm that made all the RAF cameras. It was all black and white, there was no colour at that time at all, because colour processing is much more complicated than black and white. I've never done colour processing, but from what I've heard it is.
Was processing the cine film more complicated? I mean,
no.
How was that done?
On a square frame, and it went... The frame, it was a wooden frame with a bar at the top and a bar at the bottom with big rubber washers at intervals all the way across it, and you literally wound the film round like that and it went into the tank.
Just the same, really.
It was the same in principle, just you wound it on a different way.
Now, what else were you learning while you were there? Because it sounds, It sounds like there wasn't that much to learn. What was it that took the time? I mean, 18 months before, you said, but...
Yeah, but you see, 18 months before, I think your point about the chemicals, the constituents, they went into that in much more detail. I mean, one of the things, at the end of the course, you get the trade test. Well, one of the things you had to do is you were given 20 negatives, and you had to do 20 prints in 20 minutes. But they were negatives which were not always even, so there was a bit of cloud on one, and you had to hand shade it to even it up, so the print came out looking the same colour all the way across. Well, before the war, I know that the UT photographers, they went up in an aircraft and they took the negatives to print. Well, we didn't. We were just issued with a roll of negatives and told to get on with it. And you had, as I say, 20 minutes to do 20 prints.
Now, how long was the course in all then?
16 weeks.
So 4 months. So when would you finish? November or December, roughly?
Well, November, December, I'm not honestly sure which. November, I would think.
And anything happened while you were there, you know, anything amusing or just things that you might remember?
Well, the one thing I do remember was we had the only second-class warrant officer left in the RAF. Because in the 30s, they had two classes of warrant officer, rather like the army. But the RAF abolished a warrant officer class two, and they just literally had warrant officers. But they had one old boy who was a specialist in colour photography, and he was a WO2, and he'd retired before war broke out. But because of his expertise, they called him back again. And he said, well, I'm not going to be, I don't want to be one of those warrant officers, I'm a WO2 and I'm stopping it. So he was the only one left with just a brass crown on his sleeve instead of the Tate and Lyle coat of arms, and he had a beard. And he refused. He said, if you want me back, you have me as I come, otherwise I ain't coming. And so he used to cycle round Farnborough on his bike with his brass crown shining in the sunshine.
What was life like at Farnborough? I mean, you know...
all right, yes, the food wasn't bad, as far as I remember. And we worked quite hard, you know. I mean, you started about 8:30, I think, the first parade was, and it was probably 5 o'clock time. And then you got Joe'd for fire picket and guard duty and... as well. And then at the end of 16 weeks, we passed out.
So what happened when you passed out? Where did you go then?
When you passed out, either as an AC2, an AC1, or an LAC. But about 1 in 100 passed out as an LAC.
So what were you?
I was an AC1 when I came out of that.
That's an aircraftman?
First class. Instead of being the bottom of the pile, an aircraftman second class. So I think my pay went up from 3 bob a day to 5 and threepence. Oh, it was a big, big rise.
And where were you sent? What was your first posting?
RAF Honeybourne, 24 OTU, outside Evesham.
OTU meaning?
Operational Training Unit, which is where the bomber crews, all the various bits, the pilots, the navigators and the like, they'd all done their individual courses, and they came together at the OTU where they were crewed up and became a crew and did their final training as a crew.
What was the setup like there for you?
Honeybourne was a wartime dispersed airfield. So our living domestic site, is the word I want, was in a cherry orchard about 2 miles outside the camp in a Nissen hut with a little bowser and cold water. And then there was the central... I can't remember what they called it now, but the central site where the messes were, where the bathrooms were and so forth. And then there was the technical site, which is where the photographic section hung out.
And what were you doing there?
Variety of jobs. Amongst other things, taking all the air crew's photographs for escape photographs. Because each member of the air crew had a strip, passport size, photographed. He had a strip of 4, and they had to come in and be photographed in civilian clothes. So we had a stock of sports jackets and ties, which they were loaned to have their photograph taken.
And this was all flying crew?
All air crew, yes. They all carried that.
And the idea was that they'd conceal it and then use it.
Then, if they got down and the resistance could get them out, those were the photographs that we used in the German identity documents.
So it wasn't so much that they'd... I mean, if they were caught by the Germans, they'd never be able to conceal. This was more if they were picked up by the resistance.
If they evaded, yes, yes. And because this was the only time when we did prints on unmarked paper, because all the other paper had the Air Ministry Crown and Anchor stamped on the back of it. And whoever designed that paper, I'd take my hat off to him, because there was no way we ever got the Crown and Anchor off the back without ruining the paper in the process. So if you wanted some plain paper to do bucksheesh on, hard luck, you couldn't use RAF paper.
So that did you want to do that? I mean, was
we did do some bucksheesh, but it's a good job it's 50 years on, so I'll be finishing up in jail. We had got some plain paper for these aircrew photographs. So we did manage to sort of waste a little bit. And the other thing we got, believe it or not, was a ration of coffee. Because the German paper was very slightly cream-coloured. And the last thing we did was to wash the prints in a solution of black coffee until it was the right creamy consistency. And we actually got an official ration of coffee to do it.
Now, so what other duties were you doing?
Well, we were servicing the aircraft cameras, because the Whitleys, which was the ones that they were using at the OTU, they all carried a camera. And one of the jobs that the crews had to do was a navigational exercise where they flew around the country, but they had to pass over infrared beacons. And we had an infrared film in the camera, so that recorded each of the beacons flashed a Morse characteristic. So if there was one, say, outside Liverpool that flashed a G, and they were told that part of their exercise was to go make sure they passed over Liverpool, when we developed the film, you should get a string of G's coming up, and if you didn't, they'd missed it.
And what sort of servicing did that entail? Or was it basically just taking the film out?
Well, and also cleaning the lens, checking the shutter, you know, doing dry runs without a magazine on to make sure everything worked, checking the controls.
And which camera was it? Was this?
That was an F-24 as well.
So what you were used to?
Yeah. Yeah.
Any other duties?
Oh, the odd photographing the officer's mess dance and that sort of thing.
Now, was that part of the book she stuff, or was that?
Well, difficult to know where to draw the line somewhere. When the group captain wants a photographer there because he's got a function, you take that, if you're an AC1, you take that as official.
And so that was about it, really.
And also developing cinegun films, because part of the OTU's training was simulated air attacks. So we had some, they were either martinets or masters, which carried a cine gun. So they would do an attack on the bomber and record whether they'd hit it or not. And equally, the gunners in the turrets had another cine camera lined up with the guns. So he's firing back at the martinet, and if he gets the martinet on his film, he's obviously hit it. And we didn't get an awful lot of hits.
And how long were you there? Unless there's any more duties.
No, how long were I there? About 9 months.
You seem to have gone there just before Christmas.
43. And I went overseas in 44. Yes, about 9 months.
So, till about August?
About that, yes.
And so, any particular incidents you remember, or you know, when you were there, or was it fairly routine?
Well, it was fairly routine, but it was rather nice for me, because I don't know why, but what was the Great Western Railway, all the expresses stopped at Honeybourne, and they also stopped at Ealing. So, quite often, if I could, you'd do a week on nights, and then you got a day off for night duty, and you got a day off, the weekly one as well. So if you put the two together, you've got 2 days off. And I used to nip on the train in Honeybourne, get off at Ealing where there weren't any SPs because they were all up at Paddington, and have a couple of days at home and then go back the same way.
Now, why were your night duties? I mean, do you see what I mean? Well, I mean, couldn't you have done it in
Well, no, but these infrared films are being taken at night. So when they land back, they want to know what the results are as soon as possible. So we would then go out to the flights, get the magazine, take it back straight away and process it.
Now, so the next thing would be, you know, you're posting
got
overseas.
Got the boat list, yes.
Now, were you keen to go overseas? How did you feel? I mean,
I never even thought about it, to tell you the truth. It came as a bit of a bolt out of the blue, you know. One day, Chief, he said, oh, you've been posted. Where to, Chief? He said, you're on the boat. And that was it. Where I was going, and the face idea.
How did you feel?
Oh, excited, I think. I mean, after all, I was only 18. You know, it's quite a thing for that. I didn't really know what I was letting myself in for either.
So what preparations were made?
Well, the first thing was I went from Honeybourne to Blackpool, which was a PDC, Personnel Dispatch Centre, where the drafts, because the RAF never posted a unit as such, like the Army. You were posted as individuals. And so the draft came from all over the country, came together at Blackpool, ready to go onto the boat. And we used Blackpool football ground as were the PDC's offices, and the car park was the parade ground. And we were billeted in boarding houses, civvy houses again. Only this time it was a mixture of holiday makers and RAF blokes going overseas.
And how long were you there for?
Oh, week, 10 days, something like that. And in that time there were more injections and inoculations. And of course, kitting out.
And what kitting out? What kit did you get? Tropical kit? Or
yes.
What?
Yes.
What was tropical kit?
KD, khaki. We didn't get any greens there. I mean, the stuff in England was a Bombay bowler, the solar topi, which I never wore, and khaki drill shirts and slacks and shorts and socks and stockings and that sort of thing.
And then what about the journey out? What do you recall of that?
Well, we went by train. We got on the train about 8 o'clock at night, I think, and went up to Gourock. Got to Gourock early in the morning, got on a tender, and went out to the troop ship.
Do you know her name?
Strathaird.
And what were conditions like on the boat, on the mess deck you were put on?
Bit crowded. When everybody was in their hammocks, you couldn't stand up. Well, couldn't stand up. I could just about. But a tall bloke couldn't, because you're ducking under all the hammocks. And that was the only time I broke the golden rule of never volunteer for anything. Because my pal, who was also a photographer, said, well, there's one thing you can do on the trooper. You volunteer as a supernumerary gunner. And that gets you off all other fatigues for the whole of the journey. So I did.
What did it entail?
Well, I finished up with a Lewis gun on one wing of the bridge. Fortunately, I didn't have to use it in anger, but... Well, then the convoy had assembled, and off we went. And we were the first convoy to go through the Med. Because before that, the Med was closed to troop ships, and they had to go right down around South Africa.
Now, when would this be? Well, we're getting a bit vague on the dates, but if you can pin it down a bit for us. Would it be sort of August 44?
Work backwards. I came home in early 47, and I was out there for 2 years and 9 months, so 47, 45, fairly early 44, I think. No, more the middle of 44. And when we'd sailed, we were told that our destination was Bombay.
It was summer when you left then?
Yeah.
Now, what do you remember of the journey upon, you know?
Blooming long, 28 days. Because, in fact, we steamed halfway across the Atlantic first and then turned left and went south and then turned left again and went through Gibraltar, the Straits of Gibraltar, and straight through the Med over on the African side. And the convoy was attacked, and one of the troop ships, in fact, was sunk. But unfortunately, it wasn't our one. Unfortunately, also, there were very few casualties. They managed, it didn't go down very quickly, and it gave them the time to get everybody off it. Then we went through the Suez Canal down to Aden, and that was a talk about hot. The Red Sea was murder. It really, I mean, down, I remember which deck it was, something like G deck. It was below the waterline, and it was bloody hot. It really was airless and stuffy. In fact, we used to, where we could, sleep out on deck. And then from Aden, we went straight across to Bombay. And it took 28 days from England to Bombay.
So nearly a month.
Yeah, yeah.
And what happened, what were your first impressions on arriving at Bombay?
Amazement, I think, because everything was so completely different. And we went to another PDC, in fact, at a place called Worli, W-O-R-L-I, one of the suburbs of Bombay.
What happened there?
Well, there, after being there a few days, I got posted to 681 Squadron.
Now, this is to be your squadron for the next 2 years.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, where exactly were they?
Well, at that time, the squadron base was Alipore, which was an airfield on the edge of Calcutta. So my posting took me from, in fact, it took me from a PDC in Bombay to another transit camp in Calcutta. We went right across India on a troop train.
What do you remember of that? Because that
bloody
awful.
Indian
trains
bloody
were
awful.
An experience.
Well, the troop train was the worst of the lot because it had no priority. And most of the line, I mean, it's 1,200 miles from Bombay to Calcutta. And most of the time it's single track railway. So every time there's a mail train or something coming the other way, we got shunted off into a loop siding until it had gone by. And that was usually when the cooks cooked up the meals. But it was hot, it was crowded, it was dirty, it was dusty. And it was our first time using Asiatic-type toilets, you know, hole in the floor. And the flushing was a tap. I don't remember this, it was a tap. Instead of having a handle, it had a lever with a big weight on the end. And you lifted it up to get the water and let it go, and the weight shut it off. But we got to Bombay.
What about the countryside as you passed? I mean,
mostly it was a flat desert. But the amazing thing was, when we pulled off into one of those loops, no matter where we were, we could be out flat desert within minutes. There's a flock of chickos, kids. Where they came from, Lord knows. But the whole train surrounded with chickos, begging for sweets, for money, for food. And it was quite amazing.
Now, what happened when you actually got to Alipore, RAF
Alipore? Well, I went into a transit camp in Calcutta. And there it was a question of, well, I was already posted to 681. And the orderly room of the transit camp rang up the squadron orderly room. And I think there were three of us, me and two others. And they sent a truck over, a carry over, to pick us up.
And what were your first impressions when you got to Alipore?
Amazing, because the squadron was billeted in the Maharaja of Burdwan's palace. So it was quite comfortable.
Can you describe it, the sort of thing it was like?
Well, like the sort you see on television, you know, the domes and very high rooms, no external walls. They were just sliding, folding shutters. And they'd built a cookhouse and a mess out in the grounds at the back. So we lived in the palace and went across to the mess for grub.
Now, what about the food? What was it like?
From memory, I think it was variable. Sometimes it was really good. Sometimes it was lousy.
Now, what would be good? What would be lousy? Do you see what I mean? Was it what was served up?
I think...
Was it Indian in origin? You know,
oh, no,
or was it
no.
Sort of bully beef, the usual British stuff?
British stuff. Well, and meat. I mean, beef and chicken. But usually, I think they were about 20 years old. They were a bit tough and stringy. And the other thing you had to be careful about was that the dining room was in the palace proper. So you got your grub in the mess and you had to walk back to the dining room, and you quickly learnt that you had your food in one plate and another plate on top of it. Because if you didn't, the kite hawks would be and your grub's gone.
Did that really happen to you?
Oh, yeah. No, not. I've seen it happen. Oh, yes, without any doubt. In fact, I've seen a bloke in sickbay where the kite hawk missed a bit and his claws went across the back of his hand and they all went septic.
So it wasn't just an old story. Oh, no. It actually happened.
Oh, no, yeah. Yeah. Seen it happen several times. Because being rotten lot, when we got a new bloke to come in, we never told him, and we'd be up on the first floor balcony looking down, watching, knowing what was going to happen. And they lost their grub.
Now, could you sort of describe the composition of the squadron and the role of the squadron? I mean, what was...
Well, 681 was a photographic reconnaissance squadron. There were two in the Far East. There was 681 and there was 684. And 681 in the main operated Spitfires and 684 operated Mosquitoes. But we still had a few Dutch B-25 Mitchells, because the Dutch had a squadron of Mitchell bombers in Java. And when the Japs came in, they got away to Singapore and then up to India, whereupon the RAF commandeered them and converted them into PR aircraft. So that was... The way they operated at that time was that the squadron was based at Alipore, but most of its operations were done up forward in Burma, either Imphal or Moniwa or somewhere like that. So usually what happened was the aircraft were operating, say, out of Imphal, and at the end of the day, the films would be loaded into a Harvard and brought back to Calcutta for processing. And when the aircraft needed servicing or repairs, then it came back to Calcutta. And the photographic section was up on the airfield.
So, well, could you describe the air, the nature of the airfield at Alipore? You know, what did it look like? What was the sort of layout?
Well, it was like a peacetime airfield. I mean, concrete runways. The billets, the buildings were mostly brick with a thatched roof. Our section certainly was.